Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to episode 621 with my guest, Liz E. I am Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit rattling around in our skulls. It is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist, but I am a little nutty. And I hope that counts for something. I wanted to read this email that I got. We talked about psych ward experiences an episode or two back, and a lot of them were really shitty, where people felt really, really alone. And I got this from a listener called Jamie. And she writes, I wanted to reach out because I recently started a chaplaincy internship at a major hospital. First off, I know the word chaplain has immediate connotations of Judeo-Christianity, but every last staff, chaplain and intern, even the Catholic priests, are full-heartedly interfaith. Chaplains are there for spiritual care of any kind, including simply being a listening ear. I find it a bummer that that isn't made more clear to people from the outset, given how stressful it is for patients and family alike to find themselves in a hospital. So to all your listeners, your hospital's spiritual care team is 100% down with whatever it is you're coming from and work long hours with crappy pay for the sole purpose of being there for you. I found it extraordinary myself how, when working with a patient, the rest of the world disappears. In that moment, you really are all that matters. Which leads me to the main point I wanted to reach out about. Your show has been one of the most significant influences for me, not only in my own personal struggle with the deluxe package of my own mental health issues, but also in my ministry. In my years of listening, I've heard survey after survey from people with terrible psych ward experiences, especially concerning burned out staff, making them feel all the more alone. And I wanted to let the listeners know, if you're feeling unseen and unheard in the psych ward by anyone, from staff to nurses to doctors, and this is in caps, you can call for a chaplain. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Our job is love. That's it. Zero religious agenda. Patients in deep depression, all-out psychosis, everyone, we are here for you to listen, love, advocate. In the meantime, thank you, Paul, for all the listening and loving you provide through your show. I, for one, don't know where I'd be without it. And with the utmost love and appreciation, go fuck yourself. I appreciate that. And the one thing that that touches me deeply is people tell me to go fuck myself. I don't know where I'd be without that. I don't think anything has helped me grow as much as a nice go fuck yourself. The end of an email. Those of you that are new, that's a little inside joke we have here. The Mental Illness Happy Hour is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. I have a great therapist. Her name is Heidi. She's a great listener and she's very wise. So if you have never tried online therapy, give it a shot. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. plus it's affordable. Think of it as a trip to the auto shop to tune up your engine. You know, our brain doesn't come with an owner's manual, and I think therapy is the closest thing that we can get to it. So just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with the therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/mental. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mental. And make sure you include the slash mental part so they know that you came from the podcast. And that would be awesome if you did that. And then this is the only survey we're going to read for this episode. And this is an awfulsome moment from way back, but I think it's worth reading again. And this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Just a Mess. She writes, I had ordered 2 bikes for my fiancé and I as Christmas presents on Black Friday. When I ordered them, I didn't realize I had to pick them up by the following Tuesday or the 50% discount would no longer apply. So, Tuesday evening, after receiving a warning email, I drove to the store with my car, thinking I could fit it. I could fit them in the back of my car after putting down the back seats. After waiting for 30 minutes to be helped, a worker brought down the 2 bikes, and I immediately realized there was no way they would fit in my car. I asked if they had a bike rack I could purchase. The clerk showed me one that was way more than I wanted to spend, and I asked if it was easy to install. He said it was. I brought the rack outside in the dark and rain to try and install it on my car. The pictures made no sense to me, and I couldn't figure it out. The papers began flying all over the parking lot, and I had to chase down the box the rack came in. Feeling frustrated, I went inside the car to warm up. I looked down and had not only gotten my period, but bled through my leggings. Feeling defeated, I went to go inside and tell the workers I wouldn't be able to bring the bikes home that day. I'd been at the store for over 2 hours, and I knew that my fiancé would be wondering where I was. While waiting in line, I got a text from my fiancé saying, "How soon until you're home?" I clicked on it to respond, but then the clerk was ready to talk to me. He seemed to be looking down when I realized that my fiancé had not only sent a text message, but a dick pic that was now taking up most of the phone screen. I awkwardly shoved the phone in my pocket and explained to the worker there was no way I could install the rack. He then said he could probably help me out. In his shorts and t-shirt, he went back outside and helped me for a half hour installing this rack and getting the bikes on it. I was so grateful for him. He restored my faith in humanity. And my fiancé, he better like those goddamn bikes.
Your fear of death is your love of life in reverse.
I'm a kinky person.
I didn't want to be...
I'm ashamed.
A sexual being.
Deeply ashamed.
You are...
I want to live...
Fucking depressed.
But how?
I can't do this anymore.
I will be uncomfortable so you will be comfortable.
Is life just a series of perpetual losses?
You're not depressed. We're Black.
There is no real chance for intimacy.
We don't do that.
Without... risking being hurt.
Push it all down.
You can't go around it.
Arland, like, we don't do mental health talk.
Through is the only path.
No one is ever alone. There's somebody else out there.
Don't forget.
Experiencing the same thing as you.
That the places you feel most broken now.
You just gotta look for them.
Will one day be your greatest strength.
And when you find them, it's a great feeling.
And I'm suddenly feeling horrible about making that joke, but that's how far I will go to get a laugh because I am empty inside.
Ah, you're in the right place.
I am here with my buddy Liz E., who I've known for, 8 years? 10 years?
Well, 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've seen each other go through a lot. And one of the reasons you've been on my to-do list of people from our support group that I've wanted to have on, because I've always enjoyed talking to you. I've always enjoyed your shares. You're somebody that isn't afraid to dig out the truth, even if it's ugly. And you went through a period of depression recently that kind of took you by surprise. Can you talk about that?
I did. In fact, it's so recent that it still chokes me up because of how hard it was. And first of all, thank you for having me.
You're so welcome.
You've always been such a safe person for me. I think you were one of my first male friends in our support group. So yeah, I've struggled for a long time actually with depression. It probably started all the way back when I was maybe 16 or 17 years old. And recently, I would say it was in August, I had a complete breakdown.
And it was the worst your depression has ever been?
Ever.
Wow.
Yeah, ever.
And was it driven by a particular event?
I think I was in denial for a long time. I felt it coming on for about a year.
Did the wrong person get chose on The Bachelor?
More like I was put on the wrong medication.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole medication aspect to it, too.
And what... I assume that your shrink was tweaking your meds because you weren't feeling ideal?
Correct.
Okay.
I was actually told about 6 years ago that most likely I was on the wrong medication.
That's always nice to hear.
Because I had so much anxiety around it, I was afraid to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And so I just kept pushing myself, like, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. And there came a point when I couldn't do it anymore.
What, not that it matters because everybody reacts differently to different meds, mm-hmm. but just out of curiosity, mm-hmm. what was the one that got added?
So I'm titrating off of one and mm-hmm. onto another.
What are you titrating off of?
So I'm coming off of Lexapro, mm-hmm. which was incredible in the beginning. It helped really well, kind of get me out of my first bout. And then it just kind of stopped working for me. So now they added in Cymbalta. Mm-hmm. So I had a doctor actually run a blood test to see what would work best for me. And that was the one that would work best, better than Lexapro.
Really?
Yeah. So in a way, it made me feel less anxious because yeah. I was like, oh, my body is going to say, like, this is okay, right? So I was trying to trust the science a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I am adding in Cymbalta. And because every dosage takes 4 to 6 weeks to adjust to, it's been a really long process. So I started back on August 16th was when I added in the Cymbalta.
And we're talking right now in the middle of November.
Yeah. So it's been 3 months of slowly coming out of a very dark hole.
So it's not that the Cymbalta is not working. It's just taken a while to kick in. And and so right now you don't have any med really working for you because you're titrating off the other one.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to think that the Cymbalta is at a pretty good place because I do feel a lot better than I did 3 months ago. But I still have the rest of the Lexapro to get out of my system. And then once that's out, I kind of have to wait and see how I feel. Mm-hmm. And if I don't do well, then I might have to add in more Cymbalta.
Have you been getting the brain zaps?
Yes.
Talk about those.
Oh my gosh. I had a psychiatrist. This is part of why I find it so hard to get really good mental health care is because there's psychiatrists out there. I had one where I said, I'm having brain zaps. And this was even with Lexapro. I wasn't missing a dose. Mm-hmm. I would take my Lexapro every day, same time every day. And I would go in there and say, I'm having brain zaps. And she looked at me and goes, what are those?
You've got to be kidding me.
No, not kidding you. And it was like,
scoot up.
That's, it made me lose faith in psychiatry. You know, if I can't trust you to even know these symptoms, how can I trust you to medicate me properly? Right?
Yeah.
So again, it was like, let me stop talking to her. And again, I'm just going to go back out on my own and do everything I can think of doing to make myself feel better. But I'm actually struggling and denying it.
That is a bad place to be.
Yeah.
That is a bad place to be.
Yeah. And so now every time I go down on my Lexapro, I get the brain zaps, of course, which are these electric pulses in my brain that seem to be triggered by like rapid eye movement. So if you...
Oh, really?
So if I'm looking straight and I happen to look to the side of the room with just my eyes, I get like this zzz feeling inside my brain. It's very bizarre. It's very uncomfortable. It's not painful.
I've had them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never connected it to the eye movement.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a shitty feeling. But you know, the positive, and you know, forgive me if I'm being, you know, a Pollyanna. I always try to find the positive and things if possible. Is it reminds you that your meds are helping you,
right?
You know, once the depression begins to come back, brain zaps aside, it's a reminder to me that, oh, I need these. Mm-hmm. I need these pills until something better comes along, because I'm certainly no fan of big pharma, as I'm sure you're not either.
No.
But I think the curse of the medicated is we always, when we start feeling good, is we begin to think, well, I don't need them. I feel great.
Yes. I actually know people that stop taking them because they start to feel better. And then I watch them slowly decline. And I'm like, stop doing that to yourself. It's a pattern. I've watched people do it over and over and over again. You're feeling better because the meds are working.
Yeah.
Don't you want to keep feeling better? I do. I don't want to go back to that hell. It was awful. I almost didn't make it.
What described the depths of it?
Mm.
What your brain was telling you, what you were feeling, how you viewed yourself, the world?
So I think over the course of about the last year, maybe a year and a half, I was noticing that I wasn't as interested in doing the things that I used to do, that my life wasn't as full anymore, mm-hmm. that I wasn't spending as much time with my friends, that I was starting to get anxious going to certain places. I didn't want to go to the grocery store.
What did the anxiety feel like? Was it just a thought, or was it in your body as well?
Both.
How would you experience it in your body?
I started to get triggered at, this might sound crazy, red lights. So there's really big intersection close to my house. Mm. And when I would get in heavy morning traffic and I'd be stuck at a red light surrounded by cars, I would feel very lightheaded and shaky. My knees would get weak. And then my thoughts were, you're going crazy. You're going to pass out. How embarrassing. Get out. Like, it was sheer panic of, I need to get out of my car.
And was it like because of a feeling of claustrophobia?
Yeah, I've actually had a few situations in my past where I have been stuck, like physically stuck in some scary situations. So I think I have this underlying fear now of not being able to get out. So it's triggered. Sometimes I get triggered when I'm getting my hair done, when I'm getting my nails done, because I'm powerless, right? My hands are...
That's so interesting.
My hands and feet are, like, I can't just get up and walk out. I need to be able to always get out. Yes.
In your previous life, childhood, are there any traumatic events where it involved you feeling trapped?
I've had a pretty wild, I'd say adolescence, especially adolescence, where I've been in scary situations or around scary people. And I've been in, like, there was a club where there was a shooting and everyone ran out at the same time. And there was like a stampede at the door and I got trampled at the door.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to have like a security guard, like, grab me by the shoulders and pick me up. And
you think that factored into?
No. Doesn't that happen to everybody?
Oh my God. I'm so sorry. You experienced that. And you know, I apologize if it sounds like I'm trying to, you know, say, well, this is this and this came from that. It's more my curiosity that I'm asking these questions rather than.
I have the same curiosity. Trust me. These are things I've been trying to figure out for years and years and years where stuff comes from, you know, because I feel like if I can find that answer, then it's like, oh, I'm cured. Figured it out. You know, that's not always, sometimes, yes, it helps, but that's not always how it works, you know, but it is nice to know.
So you're experiencing panic?
Yes.
In different places?
Yes.
Any suicidal ideation?
Yeah. So then I feel like back in December, I have a lot of toxicity in my family, my immediate family. And it got to a place where it was weighing so heavily on me emotionally that I had to draw really hard boundaries with my family, which meant spending less time with them. And I'm very close to my mom, but my mom is very codependent on my dad. So I don't get a lot of my mom when I need her.
And has that kind of always been the case?
Yes. Yes. My family dynamic is my mom is codependent with my dad. My dad is codependent with my mom. My dad's an addict, and my dad is also addicted to my brother, who is also an addict. So the three of them, it's like this little toxic world, mm-hmm. and I only fit into it if someone's sober that day or if I ask in advance to spend time with my mom, you know, things like that. And
so there's kind of a dysfunctional currency.
Oh, for sure.
That wins you
100%
attention, mm-hmm. accolades, mm-hmm. or just avoiding someone's wrath.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about those.
Yeah, it's...
Give me some snapshots of interactions with your family, whether they involve you or not, that can kind of paint a picture for me and the listener.
I think, so my dad's an alcoholic. He's
still
to this day.
I mean, actively drinking.
Yes, actively drinking. Okay. Yes, yeah. Actively drinking to this day. My brother is an addict, alcoholic and pills and mm-hmm. other things. He just finished 30 days in rehab. This is the longest he's been sober in probably 20 years.
That's hopeful.
So, yeah, you know, fingers crossed we actually might get a same Thanksgiving this year, but I don't know.
Oh, man. Just bring up politics. That usually smooths things out.
Oh, gosh, no. Because they don't have the recovery to be able to know when to not talk about things.
Yeah.
And then my mom is more of the... kind of Al-Anon, kind of untreated Al-Anon. She's recently started Al-Anon, though, and is working mm-hmm. the steps finally, which is incredible. So my mom is very, very religious. She raised me the same way she was raised. And these are her words. I'm not, you know, making mm-hmm. this up for her. Where children are to be seen and not heard. So it was do as I say. You don't have a voice. You must behave or you will be punished.
Where was she raised and what was the religion?
She was raised Catholic originally, and then they converted to Christianity.
Just kind of general Christianity.
But like very Christian, like church twice a week, read the Bible every day. It was very ingrained in me where, you know, God's always watching me and I have to behave and I have to be good or I'm going to go to hell. Or
so it's a punishing, the idea of a punishing God. That can be so difficult when you get into support groups and if you're introduced the idea of a higher power too.
Yeah. Because unfortunately, because things would happen in my life where I would feel responsible for something happening, thinking, oh my gosh, now I'm going to be punished by God. And it was something that I had no control over, that I don't feel that God, my God now, is a punishing God. God is not human. God doesn't have characteristics like this, right? He's not going to, you know, harm someone else to punish me,
right?
For example. You know, so I really had to work really hard to change my concept of what God was or God is for me.
So going back to the depression, mm-hmm. If you're comfortable talking about suicidal ideation, when did that creep in? What did that look like?
Yeah. So,
and what generally kind of was the conversation in your head? Because mm-hmm. I imagine the recovered part of you didn't disappear, but it was up against a pretty vicious enemy.
I get choked up even now. If I cry, I apologize in advance. It was like I was watching myself become less and less and less myself. Where I was saying before, my world was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I was spending more time sleeping on the weekends. And I was spending more time on the couch watching TV. And I kept thinking, oh, I'm just tired. oh, I kept making all these excuses. And I was even working with a therapist at the time. And all I kept talking about was, oh, I'm stressed out because someone triggered me at work. There was always an excuse for it, always a reason for it. And then one day in August, I woke up and I didn't feel right. Something just felt off. I was having a little bit of anxiety. And
at that point, how long had you been tapering off of Lexapro?
I hadn't started yet.
Oh, so this led to the decision that I need to change something up.
Yeah. Okay. This led to the decision. This scared me enough to finally make a change. So that morning when I woke up, I felt so off. So I called out of work. I took the day off. And I said, maybe I just need to rest. And I rested. And that feeling didn't go away.
Yeah. And Liz has a job that she loves.
Yes, I do. I'm very well respected and highly regarded.
It's a dream job.
It is. I'm very blessed right now with what I do and who I work for. And they don't really know anything about my past. And it's like this nice clean slate. And I called my HR manager and I burst into tears. And I told her, I don't know what's going on. I don't feel well and I need a couple days at home. There's a million reasons why I love where I work, because they do have so many resources and they fully support, I mean, you name it, diversity. I mean, we're so big on diversity and inclusion and women and health, and there's so much support. And I just knew that this one particular person in our HR department would receive what I was going to say. Because it's not something that I was comfortable talking about. I have my own stigma around it, which is crazy, you know?
It's funny. I think a lot of us have a double standard. Yeah, we're okay with other people looking like they don't have it together. But when it comes to us, it's like, no, I don't want to inconvenience anybody or look weak or weird.
And that's exactly it. It made me feel so weak. I felt so weak. Like, how could this happen? How could I let this happen again? I was blaming myself.
Do you remember what the HR person said?
She said to me, take the time you need. If you want to work or not, if you want to work, you can work from home. I won't tell anyone else what's going on with you. You have my full confidence. Let me know what you need and how I can support you.
What'd that feel like?
Pretty incredible, because I don't think I've ever had that at another job before.
Have you ever had that at home?
No, because I've pretty much been doing life on my own since I was 18 and out of the house. So all the big things I've gone through, I've gone through them alone. I'm single. I've never been married. I have two kids. So it's always been just me taking care of myself. And even with this recent bout, I was alone. I had to go through it alone.
Talk about that.
It was awful. I needed people with me because I didn't feel safe being alone. The feelings of depression were getting more and more intense. That I no longer trusted myself to keep myself safe. I didn't necessarily want to hurt myself because of the work I have done, the recovery I do have, the love I have for myself and my life now. But I didn't trust that I would be able to stop the thought if it became too strong. I no longer felt like I controlled my body and my thoughts.
It's also scary too, because you don't know if you've hit the bottom of your depression yet.
Yeah. And I think I was standing on my balcony just getting some air. And I remember thinking, what if I just jump over? I'm on the second floor. And that became my kind of obsessive thought of, this is how I get myself out of this. And I remember reaching out to my mom and telling my mom and saying, It's not that I want to, but I don't know if I'll be able to stop myself because I'm that sad and I'm that miserable. And there's this heavy weighted blanket on my brain and I can't think straight and I can't see straight. I couldn't even drive because I couldn't see straight.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. I couldn't drive.
So you couldn't even run people over
no.
to get your anger out.
No.
That is a sad
I
place
know.
To be.
I know. No more, you know, no points. I couldn't collect any points on the street. I know.
I had no idea the depth of it. You know, when yeah. you shared in our meetings that you were going through some depression,
yeah.
You also gave off a little bit of a vibe that you wanted people at arm's yeah. lengths. It's like you wanted to strike that balance between letting people know what was going on, but afraid of being pitied or I'm not sure what fear was going on, if any, in your brain when you did open up to us.
Well, it's interesting because like we talked about the stigma, right? I had so much shame around it because I was afraid of what people were going to think of me.
Even in our support group.
Even in our support group. Because here's the thing.
We share the most fucked up,
I know.
Embarrassing
I
things.
I know. I could tell you some of the most scandalous things I've done and not bat an eye. But when it comes to this, this is what happens. I come into a room or a meeting to one of our support groups and I'll canvas the room. And because I do struggle with, you know, relationships and intimacy and stuff like that, I'll go, oh, that guy's kind of cute. I can't share about myself because he might not like me anymore.
Got to keep the image up.
I have to keep the image up. Even though he could be married, he could be gay, he could be like... Mm-hmm. Even if he's straight, he might not be interested in me because people are allowed to not be interested in me. But if there was that 1% chance that he might be, I couldn't let him know what was going on with me, which is so stupid because if someone is interested in me, they're going to have to find this stuff out anyway.
It's like in the moment,
but it's like,
we don't think
I have
it through.
To trap him first. And then I show the ugly stuff. Come on. That's how we do it. Let me get you my web first.
Well, let's segue into that. Let's talk about the history yeah. of feeling battling yourself in finding intimacy.
Yeah.
When did that start?
Gosh. Probably when I was 5.
And
my earliest memories would have been, I remember becoming very infatuated with the male-female relationship. I think because so much of it was hidden from me by my parents, and I was also getting very mixed messages from my parents at the time. My mom was more like, follow the Bible, right? And the Bible will lead you, and God will lead you to your person, and all these big ideas. And my dad was more of a worldly...
Not as religious as your mom.
Not as religious. And also, he would have like a Playboy magazine on his nightstand and my mom would have a Bible on her nightstand. I know. I'm the product of that.
That is going in the opening montage for next year.
So I'm the product of that yeah. where it's...
That's all you need to say.
That's all I need
We're
to say.
We're going to wrap
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
That explains That's everything.
Me. My dad would encourage me to use my sexuality to get what I wanted. And would then he, my mom would tell me that I would be punished.
Wow.
Yes. He would tell me, literally, if my car was at the mechanic, he would say, well, show some cleavage and maybe you can get a discount.
Oh, my God.
Dirty jokes. I mean, it's disgusting. To this day, I'm disgusted by my dad.
Have you ever felt a... creepy vibe towards you from
ooh,
him?
Ooh.
I guess
Does that answer your
yes.
question? Yes.
If you're comfortable, obviously you're not, but I'm going to ask you anyway. if you
of
wouldn't
you are.
Mind talking more about the difficult to talk about.
Yeah.
And if you're not comfortable, totally get it. But you and I have spoken many times about this,
yeah,
and which is why I'm...
There's no secrets here.
Right.
There's no secrets here. There's actually a lot that I don't know. I think I've Actually, I know I've blocked a lot of stuff out because I've learned so well how to trust my body. I'm so in touch with my body that when there's something going on around me that doesn't feel right, I can feel it right away.
Is that a new thing or has that always been that way?
It's been that way for at least the last 6 or 7 years since I started doing some of this recovery work.
And what a gift that is to begin to have your body be your friend. I mean, what a novel concept.
I know. Wow, I can trust my gut. Who knew? But my relationship with my dad was always based on accomplishments. Mm. You know, if I played sports so that he would come and coach my games. And I tried to do well in school so that he would say, good job. And then, of course, if I didn't do well, he punished me. He spanked me. There's probably been, there's been stories me and my sister have tried to kind of pick apart where she feels at one point he may have touched her inappropriately. And there was probably not a whole lot of healthy boundaries. I feel like he definitely crossed some sexual boundaries when we were younger. Probably showering together until we were like a little too old to shower together, things of that nature. So to this day, I have trouble looking at him in the eye. Oh my gosh, I just realized. Sometimes when I'm come across a man who I find attractive, I have trouble making eye contact. I don't know, that just hit me really
well. Wow.
Yeah. It's like look away, shy away.
One of the things that really helped me in recovery to be able to describe accurately the feeling I get around my mom is that she drinks me in with her eyes. And I think a lot of people experience that from a parent, whether that parent is well-meaning or not, but it's a creepy thing to experience, the weight and the invasion of that kind of look. And I think it's important to talk about the things that aren't criminal but fuck us up.
And
that's, I think, where so much of the work can be done is, you know, turning to a parent and saying, why did you just wolf whistle at your daughter? That's not cool.
And even recently, he tries to tell us jokes that he should probably only share with other men his age. And he tells them to me and my sister, and I look at him and I'm like, can you please not? That's disgusting. That's totally inappropriate.
And how would he, you're how old, Liz?
44.
You're 44, and it hasn't sunk in what your taste in jokes is.
No.
By this point, which tells me that your dad's kind of a narcissistic guy,
100%.
Which is a bit redundant when you're talking about an untreated alcoholic. But
I, to this day, I don't want to be alone with him. I don't want to engage in conversation with him. Thank you.
Have you ever gone through a period of sadness that that's the dad you got?
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah. Sometimes I watch movies where you see a relationship between a father and a daughter, and she's like daddy's girl, and they're really close and they're doing things together. And
he recognizes what she loves.
Yes. And he fully supports her, or, you know, she's off getting married and he's crying while she's walking down the aisle, just anything like that. And I get so sad thinking, I'm never going to have that. I've never had that. I'm never going to have that. And I feel like I got cheated out of that experience, you know? I think part of that is why I also crave to find relationships, particularly if I could find someone that has a really large family. Like, I want to be part of someone else's family. I want to be like adopted into someone else's family, whether it's through a romantic relationship or platonic relationship. Like, can I go adopt some grandparents somewhere? Like, I'm craving that wholesome family environment, especially from my dad, because if I didn't get that from him, I was never taught from him what a healthy relationship looks like. I was never taught from him what it feels like to be valued and respected by a man. I have nothing to gauge, right? Like, there's, I go out into the world and I try to date and I'm like, I don't know how I'm supposed to be treated because no one ever showed me that. In fact, I was showed the opposite. I was showed to use my body. And that's how I connected with men, was by using my body. And then, of course, I expected the love to follow that, and it never does.
This episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Just imagine that you're at the vet and you get a bill, or they say, well, to do this operation on your dog, it's going to cost such and such, and you love your dog or your cat, and you don't have the money to pay it, and you have to make that very, very difficult decision. Well, the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. One more time, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And so when did you kind of hit bottom with that? Are there any snapshots of moments where you were like, I need help?
About 11 years ago, I was breaking up my second engagement. We were planning our wedding. And I started having uncontrollable panic attacks. And so I found a therapist thinking, I just have cold feet. It's something in the relationship that's off. Help me fix my relationship. And the more she and I started talking, I realized it was so much bigger than that, that it wasn't the relationship. It was me. I was engaged in getting married to someone that I didn't really love. I didn't really respect. He wasn't very nice to me. And I was in it because part of my dis-ease is finding people to fall in love with me, to, again, the get them. And then once I got them, it was like, what did I do?
I'm
trapped with this person.
Would there be a fantasy about who this person was in the beginning? What were the typical fantasies that you had about who this person was and could be to you? And what would that bring to you, what this person had to offer?
I think part of it was ego, that I have someone that loves me so much, he wants to marry me, which also fed my self-esteem and my self-worth. So it fed all of those things that I didn't have.
So it was about you more than that person.
Oh, 100%. they were probably good looking, probably loved bombed me in the beginning. Complete, like, so much attention and gifts and love.
Oh,
and
fucking I want run. You fucking like, run.
But an untreated person, right, sees that and is like, give me more, you know?
And this is going to last forever.
Yeah. Prince Charming. I wanted Prince Charming. My fantasy was Prince Charming. My fantasy was, I'm Cinderella. Come and rescue me from my life. Let's get married and go right off into the sunset together. I wanted a big wedding because I wanted the wedding, not the other stuff.
The life after.
I didn't want the life. I wanted the wedding. I wanted the dress. I wanted the ring. And I wanted the bragging rights. That's what I wanted.
What does it feel like when you say that out loud?
I can kind of laugh at it now because I've done so much work and I'm so detached from it. And it's been obviously 11 years. And I actually feel completely different now. Where now it's like, I don't want a big wedding. This isn't about other people. This is for me. This is intimate. This is my ideas have shifted so much that now I can look back at it and just be like, oh my gosh, it was kind of sad. It's a little sad to think, you know, this little girl, right? No matter how old I am, there's this little girl inside of me that wanted this big fairy tale, thinking that was going to solve all of my problems. And then, but now I can also add in the, wow, a lot has changed. I'm glad I'm not in that headspace right now. Mm-hmm. But I also know that I have to continuously do this work. I started to share more about my history with my relationships with men because it wasn't just this guy. There was a fiance before him, and there was a guy before him, and a guy before him. And I'm like, there's a pattern here. And I'm so sick of blaming them. All I kept saying was, another broken guy, another broken guy, another broken guy. And she looked at me and she goes, you know, you sound a lot like another one of my clients who belongs to some support groups. If it's okay with her, can I connect the two of you? And I'm, of course, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm in pain. I'm tired of this pattern. My family's so sick and tired of me at this point. My sister rolls her eyes at me when I say, even talk about going on a date at this point. And I connected with this other client of hers, and she shared her story with me, and I related 100%. And that's what led me to going to the same support groups that this other client was in. And that's when I started my self-discovery journey.
And what were some of the things you were shocked to learn? I mean, you shared a few that it was a pattern. It wasn't the coincidence of 12 guys in a row that were dicks.
Yeah. There was also a pattern of not just 12 guys in a row, but 12 at the same time. I had to have a safety net at all times. I had to have because...
Backup generator.
Oh, for sure. Because if one didn't work out, I couldn't handle not having someone else there. I became so addicted to the attention and I think the high that I was getting from the attention that I almost like fell in love with intrigue. So like...
Makes total sense.
That...
It's a fucking drug.
Oh my gosh. It's like... And I remember saying things like, if I could just have the first 3 months of a relationship for the rest of my life.
It's like the first bite of pizza.
I'd be set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The rest of the pizza is downhill,
the
right?
The first bite of pizza for the rest of my life. Nice. And I'm set. But then you don't get any of the deep stuff. It's, you know.
And the deep stuff's the best stuff.
I know. I know. But at the time, it just, I couldn't even see that far. Yeah.
I used to think people were lying that would say, you know, our relationship gets better as time goes on. And I had no idea what they were talking. Yeah. I thought that they were just trying to justify their fear of leaving each other.
Yeah.
And
I would get into the, you get past the intrigue phase and then the other person's actually wanting more. And so you agree to be, you know, whether it's boyfriend, girlfriend or whatever the situation is. And then I would go, well, now what? Now what do I do with him?
Now what's going to get me high?
I know. Do I, like, what do I do with him? Do I just, like, feed him pizza in the corner of the room and, like, say hi. I don't know. Like, that's not my jam. My jam is get, more. The next one. I had so much fear of missing out. I didn't want to miss, oh, that guy's cuter than this guy. That guy's more talented than this guy. This guy's more, you know, a better profession. He's famous. So it got bigger and bigger and bigger. That's where I think I like to use the word, like, stuck. I was just stuck in this world of intrigue for so many years. And that was one of the biggest patterns I saw coming in, was that I was almost afraid to take that leap into the next phase of relationships, because I had no idea who I was. I had no idea what relationships looked like. I had no idea, like I said, what to do in a relationship. And so it was better just to keep it friendly. I didn't want to get hurt.
One of the concepts that kind of blew my mind when I first started coming to our groups is that this support group is not a program of deprivation. It's a program to help us find healthy abundance that comes in to that empty place, so that we're not pining for something that's going to give us a sugar rush but leave us feeling depleted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you begin to feel that something healthy was starting to fill that hole in your soul, your chest?
It was, I would say, about 2 years into going to groups and working through some assignments that were given to me by other people that had been in the groups, and writing out kind of like inventories for my life of relationships I had been in, looking at characteristics on paper, looking at behaviors on paper, having to write about my dad, having to write all these things, and then having to write my part in all of these situations. And I think that it was then that I also was able to look at people as more than what I could get from them, and more than the label I created for them, and see that they're actually human beings underneath too, and they have feelings too, and that if I'm acting out because of something that I'm not getting in my life, most likely they are too. I developed compassion. And I think one of the biggest turning points was that happened with my dad. When I was doing some writing about my dad. My dad came from, so when he was 7, his dad died and he was an only child, and he became like the husband and the father in that household, because it was just him and his mom. And then also my grandfather was adopted, and when he was adopted, the family that adopted him gave him their last name. So there was a piece of my dad that felt like he actually didn't really know where he came from, because our last name is adopted. So I think because my dad also felt this sense of being lost and not having a dad, and then he got into his own drinking, I was able to go, he's broken too. He's hurting too. He doesn't have any tools. He doesn't wake up every morning saying, how can I hurt my daughter today? He just didn't know what he was doing. He doesn't know what he's doing to this day. And that's what helped me start to turn a corner into seeing I can have compassion for other people.
The gift of occasionally having the conscious thought that somebody else is just scared is one of the most valuable tools. Mm-hmm. Certainly for dealing with anger.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. It's like people always say, you know, I don't blame my parents. You know, they didn't know what they were doing, or they did the best they could. And I'm like, yeah, well, they didn't do good enough.
I think that can also be true.
They didn't do good enough.
Yeah.
They didn't know what they're doing, but they didn't really do anything to make it better either.
Right.
You know, having conversations with my mom today, she clearly knows. She wasn't one for talking about her feelings, obviously, because no one, she didn't teach me how to either. Like, It's no surprise there. She's finally letting me know little bits and pieces, and it's starting to really, I'm like, oh my gosh, this makes so much sense now.
So I'm glad to hear that you feel like you're coming slowly out of the depression.
My eye color is lighter. You know, I remember I woke up one morning and I looked in the mirror and I didn't recognize my face.
Really?
My eyes were dark.
Was it because your pupils were enlarged?
I don't know. It was too scary to investigate, really. Like, I didn't want to get any closer to the mirror.
Were you with a vampire?
Maybe I am the vampire. I don't know. My color does change. The bags under my eyes. People have told me that did see me during those couple of months. That, wow, you look so much better. You look so much lighter. You know, your eye color is brighter. So you could see it on my face. You could see depression on my face. That's how low it was. And what's really cool is that, well, it's cool and it kind of makes me sad too, is the little things that I noticed that showed me that I was coming through it. I was walking my dog and I noticed the neighbor had some really pretty roses. And I was like, oh, wow, these are so pretty. And I smelled one of them.
Wow.
And I went, oh, my gosh. I just noticed a rose. And I was interested in smelling it. And then I got sad. Because I was like, when was the last time I had any interest in even smelling a rose? I had forgotten all these little joys. The fact that I love a sunset. The fact that I love the moon. The fact that I get joy out of seeing beautiful flowers on the side of the road, I couldn't even see them. They brought me nothing. People would tell jokes, and I remember I even said to them, don't waste your joke on me. I won't laugh. I said that to my dad. I said, don't bother. I'm not going to laugh. He goes, why not? I go, I'm physically incapable of laughing. Sense of humor, there was nothing. I was gone. And noticing these things where I'm like, and I remember I would call people in our program and say, oh my gosh, I saw a flower today. Like I noticed a flower today. And those are the little things where I was like, I'm coming back, you know? And then I told a joke at work and then I was like, oh, I told a joke. My sense of humor is coming back. Slowly I'm coming back into this person. And it's really interesting because I was like, I think it was my daughter. I have daughters. My daughter was like, what's wrong with you tonight? And I was like, this is me. You just haven't seen her in a really long time. And then, of course, I got sad again.
All right.
Realizing how long it's been since I've been myself, you know. But I think better late than never. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that I was in the space that I'm in today where I do have a support group that helped encourage me to keep going, to remind me that I was loved, that I had built enough strength, inner strength, and built enough trust in the world and the universe and what I call my God, and that I could tell my therapist that I wasn't doing well. And even she was like, why didn't you say anything? Part of it was denial. Part of it was, I don't think I knew how bad it was. Part of it was I just didn't want to have to face it. I didn't want to have to do the work.
Yeah, I was just going to say, sometimes I don't say anything because I'm afraid they're going to make me do something that requires effort.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, she offered me inpatient treatment. It was at that point where I needed to be hospitalized. And because of the fact that I am a single mom and I do have a daughter that still lives with me at home because she has some special needs, she relies on me. And the fact that I'm probably a workaholic, I chose not to be hospitalized and to do the work myself at home. And really glad I did.
Me too. Yeah. Me too.
I'm really glad I did.
Yeah, yeah. Liz popped back into the meeting about a week or two after the one where you revealed how depressed you were. And it was, you were smiling, mm-hmm. and it was really nice.
Yeah.
It was really nice.
I had like my first belly laugh a couple yeah. of weeks ago, and I was like, my stomach muscles hurt so bad right. because it had been so long since I've laughed that hard. I'm so grateful that I get to have these moments that I do get to experience joy, you know.
And I hope I straddled the line when I texted you mm-hmm. after the meeting where you talked yeah. about your depression, because I didn't want to feel you to feel like I was encroaching on your space, but I also, you know, wanted you to know that if you want to talk.
Yeah. And I did need that from you. I did. And I did need to talk and to hang out. But I was so sick. I was so sick. I couldn't. Dialing a phone number was overwhelming. It was like, sometimes I didn't even know what I needed. It was just, I would sit on the couch and just count the minutes, praying that it would get better. And I just couldn't. I wanted to. There were so many, there were probably people I could have called and say, I'm alone. Can you please come and just sit with me? I did have people offer. Let me know if you want to go for a walk. I just couldn't do it. Like, I was so anxious and so depressed. Stepping foot outside my house was overwhelming.
Yeah. And just making eye contact with people feels like bench pressing 500 pounds.
Yeah. I couldn't have anyone need anything from me.
Mm.
So having to think about engaging in a conversation where someone's going to require me to answer a question or to give advice, or that I might have to be attentive to someone or be responsible for someone in my house or be mm-hmm. a good host or just anything, I couldn't do it.
If somebody had said to you, somebody that you felt safe with had said to you, what if I come by and you just lay, I put a pillow in my lap and you lay your head down and we'll just sit in silence.
I would have loved that. I didn't have that.
For the person who's never experienced depression, they probably can't even conceive that that would be
yeah.
a doable.
Yeah. Yeah. To have someone. Sorry, I'm wiping away tears.
It's all right.
To have someone just offer to just sit on the couch and maybe hold my hand. Would have been so amazing to just feel for a few minutes less alone and safe, and to feel someone else's presence there with me. I spent a lot of nights, I would color in coloring books sometimes. I would try to watch like funny videos, like funny cat videos on YouTube, you know, anything I could to try and lift my spirits or get out of my head.
Those have probably saved hundreds of thousands of lives.
Yeah, for sure contributed to saving mine. Thank you, YouTube cat videos. Keep them coming. My therapist gave me a list of things she would say to me to help engage, like I needed to engage, to activate right? Instead of just sitting there in the mud.
Oh, it's so fucking hard.
To activate. And so it was actually really cool because the list she gave me normally, it's like, go for a walk or go. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, screw you. I don't want to go for a walk right now. I want to stay in my house. So it was like things like get a small table fan and put it in front of you and just feel the breeze blowing on your face. Things like that were calming to me because I could feel air. Open the curtains and look out the window and just look out the window.
Oh, those sound doable.
Yeah, right? Make a cup of tea. You know, any little thing that kind of keeps you active in the world but also is not overwhelming at the same time.
So kind of takes you out of your head.
Yes.
Helps you be present a little bit without feeling like you're doing some type of exercise.
Yeah. And then I slowly expanded on that list, and I started polishing my own nails. I wanted to take a bath, but I also was afraid of the bath because of the whole suicide thing. Mm. I think that I was, again, afraid of the overwhelming urge, right? So there wasn't a whole lot of bathing going on. Mm-hmm. Petting my cat.
Oh, animals are the best.
Playing with my dog, throwing my dog's toy, playing fetch with my dog. Anything that would bring me just a little bit of pleasure, activate me, get me out of my head, get me present. Those things are literally the things that help me stay alive during the day. That's what I would turn to.
I would have just told you to smile harder and pray.
Smiling. I probably would have rolled my eyes and flipped you off.
Yeah. Well, Liz, I am so happy to be your friend and, you know, walk this crazy walk of ours and to just have our lives intersect and open up to each other. I feel like we're really blessed in the city that we live, that we have such a nice group of people to support each other. And you're one of those people for me.
Yeah, same here. I think it's incredible that when I was able to start finally voicing some of my needs, you know, it was someone else in the rooms at the time, she had asked me if there was anything she could do. And I just said, if you come across any good memes or quotes or anything, just text them to me. That was all I was able to do as far as communicating. Mm-hmm. Every single day, I got a text message every single day, whether it was something inspirational or spiritual or funny. And that's because of these programs, these groups that we all go to, that I was able to find a community who can show up for me in ways that I had wanted my family to show up for me.
Yeah.
That's what I get from you. That's what I get. Even though I wasn't able to call you back, I knew that you were just a phone call away. I knew that you were there for me. I knew because when we were in meetings, you would try to get me to share. You would try to get me to engage. So even if I wasn't able to talk to you physically, I felt your presence. And I held on to that and I kept that with me too, knowing that I have this support group around me, that there were people that loved me and cared about me.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to meeting the next douchebag you get engaged to.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, no.
See, I can't just let it end on a sweet moment. I got to come with my fucking snowshoes and fucking step on everything.
Hopefully, I won't have to ask you to, you know, protect me if I have to get a restraining order against somebody.
Liz, you fucking rock. And I will see you Wednesday night.
I will see you Wednesday night. Thank you.
Many, many thanks to Liz. You know, it is amazing how easy it is, despite having so much recovery, to not reach out for help when we need it. Oh, so glad she came out the other side. This will be the final episode of December. We're going to run best of episodes for the rest of the month. Getting shoulder surgery on the 21st. Wish me luck. And I will see you guys in the new year. And in the meantime, be nice to yourself. And never forget that you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully everybody fucked up in some weird way.